Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, April 16th, 2013, and I'm your host, Arielle Taylor, with my co-hosts, Lavendar and Anastasia. Our featured guest this evening is author Jerry Lane, and we'll be talking about his new book, The Adventure of Being Human. This book contains transmissions received by Jerry from two creator beings, whom he calls Christ Michael and Mother Spirit. As a longtime student of the Urantia book, and with a master's degree in creative writing, his new book provides supplemental information not found in the Urantia book, and because of his work, information which is immediately useful can be found. For the last 8 years, Jerry has been bringing this divine and gracious voice through in evening sessions held in his home in Northern California. His website is Evolving Souls, and there's a hyphen in between there, so it's evolving-souls, S-O-U-L-S.org. At the top of the show, it's the Starseed News segment with Anastasia, bringing topics of interest to Starseed and sharing some emails from our listeners. And we'd like to thank Chris and Fiona for hosting our switchboard this evening, and you're welcome to call in with comments or questions. The number to dial is 917-889-8292. And remember to press 1 on your keypad so we know you want to come on the air. And please remember to click follow on our show page if you like the show. If you're joining us for the first time, our main site is starseedhotline.com, where you can find a lot of vital information for Starseed in our vault of knowledge. And the entire site has been coded for Starseed activation. We have a support forum for Starseed at starseedhotline.ning.com. And we'd like to thank Rose and Tammy for their great work and dedication on behalf of our Starseed forum. You can also find us on iTunes if you'd like to download our shows to go, or you can download them right from our show page archives. We'll get started in just a moment, but first I'd like to let you know that if you want to contact us privately, the toll-free number for our website is 888-881-0881. The Stage 1 Starseed confirmations are based on Lavendar's discovery of star markings in your natal astrological chart. And the Stage 2 session is a one-on-one phone session available with Lavendar, Anastasia, or myself. Remote healing sessions with Tammy are also available. If you have a birthday coming up, you should know when your 10 hours of power will occur by getting your solar return timing. And please allow at least 2 weeks ahead of time to make sure that you do get it in time. So now I would like to introduce my co-hosts, Lavendar and Anastasia. Good evening, ladies.
Good evening, everybody. Lavendar, are you there?
I'm here, and I'm so ready to hear some news.
Well, that's just great. How are you, Arielle?
I am doing just fine because spring has finally sprung here I'm in the South, and we've waited a long time, more than
you
we used
really
to.
Have. Yes, indeed, and I can say the same. I'm in the South, and it's improving. Even the dandelions are out, which they give me such joy because, you know, dandelions have a lot of nutritional and medicinal benefits. So a lot of people think they're weeds, but I love them, and they're in proliferation right now, so it's finally happening, daffodils and all of that, and the birds are happy, so that makes me happy. It's great, and it's great to be with all the Starseed listeners tonight. I'm so happy to be here. We're going to start our new segment tonight with, as usual, talking about space, and I wanted to let you know that they have found dark matter on the International Space Station. They have a particle detector on board the International Space Station, and they say it's recorded intriguing signs of dark matter that could reveal what the mysterious substance is made of. Now, if the finding holds up, it could lead to significant advances in physics and cosmology, so they say. That's pretty sparse, information, but I'll keep an eye out for that and see what else they have to say about it. It's just a tantalizing headline. This came from spaceweather.com, by the way. And they're also reporting that there is a rapidly growing sunspot. They say that 2 days ago, sunspot AR1723 didn't even exist. And now it expands to nearly 100,000 kilometers. And that's
wow.
8 Earth diameters, by the way, across the sun's southern hemisphere. Yeah, wow is right. Now, NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory is monitoring the sunspot's rapid expansion, and they say that it has a beta-gamma magnetic field that harbors sufficient energy for M-class solar flares. And if the magnetic field is changing as quickly as the underlying sunspot, they say it would become unstable and explode. So we're advised to watch that. And also, there has been a coronal mass ejection impact that hit the Earth's magnetic field on the 13th. They say it wasn't a strong one, but there was enough to create a lot of auroras in the northern tier of the United States. So maybe some of you up north have seen that or noticed it. Now, there was a sensational thing that happened over Spain. They say that a comet fragment exploded 70 kilometers above Toledo, and this event was seen across all of Spain. There are videos of it on the internet, and it is really a whiteout. A brilliant ball of flame just streaked across the sky above the Spanish capital, Madrid. It dazzled everybody. Astronomers were even astonished by it. It was really so bright that they saw it across the entire country of Spain. It was caught on camera by the Hida Observatory at the University of Huelva at about 11:45 p.m. in their local time, and it struck the atmosphere above Madrid about that time. They say that the impact was so abrupt that the object immediately caught fire, creating a ball of flame around 100 kilometers above the Earth. And the meteor then shot towards Madrid at over 75,000 kilometers an hour before disintegrating completely at an altitude of only 70 kilometers. Now, the Spanish Institution for the Study of Meteors and Meteorites, every nation has their equivalent of these scientific groups that study these things, they classified the meteorite as a piece of comet that was, and this is what I think is humorous, they say flying by the Earth. Well, I have to question that. You know, the PTB, the powers that be, are always minimizing these incidents, but we have to have a big question mark after flying by the Earth. It obviously entered the planet's atmosphere and exploded. You can't get that kind of brightness when it's just passing by. So anyway, that's a pretty major event to lighten the whole sky across an entire nation. And also, in Adelaide, Australia, there was what they call a flaming tennis ball. In other words, it was relatively small but very, very bright, that went across the Adelaide skies here just a few days ago. And so it's happening still. We're still getting fireballs all over the planet. That's just two most recent ones. And maybe you heard about the Iran's massive earthquake, a 7.8 magnitude that struck today. It's tomorrow their time, but it happened today, and it was the strongest earthquake to hit Iran in more than 50 years. And it was a subduction zone quake, and that's the same tectonic setting that underlie the deadly tremblers in Japan, in Chile, and in Indonesia. So it happened in a critical layer of the Earth's crust. It struck 51 miles beneath the Earth's surface, where the Arabian Plate dives under the massive Eurasian Plate. And it hit at 3:14 local time in Iran. And actually, it was such a powerful quake. And they're saying now that there will be more than a 47% chance of more than 1,000 fatalities, although it's recent, and we haven't had any news on that yet that I'm aware of. But at least 34 people died in Pakistan as a result by the Iran earthquake. So it was affected by that 7.8 magnitude, affected Pakistan and killed 34 people. So that was a big quake. So we'll see what comes out of that in the way of damage and injuries from that. That's huge. And there was, in our neck of the woods here, there was an earthquake that was reported by the USGS, a magnitude of 4.3 near Luther, Oklahoma, today. And on Saturday, Papua, how do you say that? Papua, New Guinea. I can't say that. Do you know how to say that, Ariel?
I think you did a great job.
I think it's Papua New Guinea. Sorry for all you people that are familiar with New Guinea. But that was a 6.6 earthquake. And there was another earthquake in Japan. This was northwest of Sumoto that occurred on Friday. It was a 6.0. So anyway, lots of quakes as usual. But the Iranian / Pakistan earthquake is something that we will want to see what happened with that. Poor people, it's tough. Well, you know, we've been talking a lot about the poor UK and the kind of weather that they've had. They've just really been hit. And certain scientists are predicting that Britain is really headed for a real cold spell. They claim that it's due to the melting of the Arctic ice that is warming the waters, or excuse me, cooling the waters near Britain, and it's affecting the temperature. Whether or not that is valid, I cannot say. This comes from those that are global warming proponents, which is a suspicious theory to start with. But they are saying now that the British bluebells are not blooming on time. And if you've ever seen, have you seen them? You've been to Britain, Ariel. Have you seen the beautiful bluebells?
Yes.
Well, they're not blooming on time this year. They're late because it's been so cold that they're just not ready. And they think that it's going to be up to a month away and could be delayed until June, which is really unusual because they usually bloom in March. So another indicator that Britain has had such a cold, cold time. And I want to take my attention tonight to Florida. You know, we talk about Florida a lot. Floridians, you guys have really had your share of difficulties. They say that South Florida is under attack by a species that's non-native, that's threatening to wreak havoc. And it's not the pythons that got loose that made their home in the Everglades about 2000. And it's not that ravenous land-walking fish like the Asian carp that's been eating its way through the waterways. No, it's a snail. And this is a rat-sized snail. They say they grow to 8 inches long, they eat through plaster, and they can puncture your car tires if you run over them. And there's pictures of those on the Internet, and they are absolutely enormous. So this is something that has been imported. They're from Africa. They made their way into the States, like these other creatures that have happened in Florida, except for that giant mosquito I talked about last week. But they're not native, and now they are taking over, and they're causing all kinds of damage. And they're actually eating foundations of houses. So you want to check that out on the Internet. Put in rat-sized Florida snails, and you'll see big pictures of them. They're huge.
I just wonder if the French restaurants are going to capitalize on that.
that's hilarious, Zaria. You are so quick.
Sorry. I'm sorry.
That would be a good use for them. That would be great.
Well, that's a good way to, you know, deal with it, you know, put them on the menu.
It absolutely is. You are so smart, Ariel. You amaze me. Great idea. Well, anyway, I want to take my attention now to the UFO arena. There is an ex-congresswoman that's supposed or has been proposed to head a panel pushing the existence of space aliens. What do you know about that? This is out of Detroit. This comes from the Detroit News. It says that a group hoping to prove alien contact with Earth has tapped former U.S. Representative Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick to help convince the federal government to acknowledge the existence of extraterrestrials. Now, the Detroit Democrat and mother to former Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick is going to help preside over the 30 hours of congressional style. Now, that's not congressional, but congressional style hearings scheduled for April 29th to May 3rd at Washington's National Press Club. Now, she has not responded to calls for comment, but this has been dubbed the Citizen Hearing on Disclosure, the public panel that pledges to expose evidence of extraterrestrial vehicles and prompt a government effort, or let's say to get rid of the government's effort to deny the sightings of such commonly called UFOs. It's an oppositional stance to get the government shamed into disclosing information. Now, Stephen Bassett, the executive director of the Bethesda, Maryland-based research group that's hosting the hearings, said he sought the former members of Congress to interview dozens of witnesses in a style that harkens back to their work when they had congressional hearings. He said he had invitations out to about 50 former members that he thought were likely candidates to participate, but Congressman Kilpatrick was the first one to respond. So we'll keep our eye on that and see what comes out of that hearing. So citizens are still pressing forward for disclosure and turning up the thumb screws a little bit. So that's a good thing to know about. And in coming out of the San Antonio Headlines Examiner is a headline that says, FBI comes clean on 1950 UFO sighting memo from Washington, D.C. chief. And there is a photo in the newspaper of this memorandum. Now, the Federal Bureau of Investigation has come clean on a 63-year-old memo from the head of their Washington, D.C. office pertaining to UFO sightings, the article states. It says that the memo was associated to a story relayed to four FBI people from a third party reporting that an Air Force investigator had reported three flying saucers were recovered in New Mexico. Now, this is 63 years ago. The saucers were described as being circular in shape with raised centers approximately 50 feet in diameter. Now, this is in the memo. And each one was occupied by three bodies of human shape, but only 3 feet tall, dressed in metallic cloth of a very fine texture. Each body was bandaged in a manner similar to the blackout suits used by speed flyers and test pilots, the memo goes on to say. Now, in an FBI release that they put out on the 24th of March this year, the Bureau indicates that the story is the single most popular file in their various records released under the Freedom of Information Act. And they say that over the past 2 years, this file has been viewed nearly a million times. They say that this is a single memo from March 22nd, 1950, from the Washington, D.C. office lead person, Guy Hotel. Now, this man died in 1990. But this memo was addressed to J. Edgar Hoover, who was the head of the FBI at the time, and the memo was recorded and indexed soon after that. And the informant made the claim that the saucers had been found because the government's high-powered radar in the area had interfered with the controlling mechanism of the saucers, thus leading to the crash. The memo ends with, quote, no further evaluation was attempted, end quote, concerning the matter by the FBI agent. Now, the FBI said that when their vault released this information in 2011, some media outlets noticed that the hotel menu and had erroneously reported that the FBI had posted proof of a UFO crash at Roswell, New Mexico, and the recovery of wreckage and alien corpses. Well, the FBI has something to say about that. They say that they have only occasionally been involved with any investigation of UFO and extraterrestrial sightings, and that this particular memo is not new. It certainly was a first, they say, publicly released in the 1970s, and they say that there is absolutely no connection to the infamous events of July 1947 in Roswell. They say there is no connection. So anyway, we have releasing of information and ferocious denial going hand in hand. We call that the Hegelian debate, where they're set up a dialectic where it messes with your head. You get positive information, then you get corresponding negative information, and everyone is always left not knowing what's up. That is a method of psychological manipulation and keeps people unable to come to any conclusion. Very deliberate attempt. They pull this on us all the time, the Hegelian dialectic. We can expect that everywhere in the UFO field. This is all meant to keep people clueless and frustrated. And that is where we are with the Starseed News tonight. And it's been great to be with you. I'm looking forward to the show. I'll be able to be online for just a little bit, and then I have to excuse myself. I have an appointment.
Okay, Anastasia, I just wanted to ask you something.
Yes.
Have you heard anything about the Joshua trees blooming?
No, I haven't. Do you know anything about that? Can you share that with us? That's
well,
that's
no.
Important.
You know, I brought it up, but now I don't have an answer. Richard the other day said something about that there were Joshua trees all over the planet that were blooming now, and that I think they don't do that, but once ever, you know, so many years.
That's right. That's right.
And that it's happening everywhere, all over the planet, wherever Joshua trees are.
I have to find out about that. You know, I lived quite a while in Palm Springs, and in that area of the country, I'm going to have to look up that, and that's
no,
important.
Next week, okay?
Yeah, next time we get together, I'll do that. Thank you so much. Anybody that knows anything about that out there, how about sending me an email?
Yeah, that'd be good, yeah.
Anastasia@starseedhotline.com. Well, you all have a beautiful week, and I give you all my love, and let's just keep on shining.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Anastasia.
Thank you, Ariel.
Fascinating stuff this week. And we do have our featured guest with us on the switchboard, so I'm just going to get to your microphone and open it up here in just a second. Hello, Jerry. Welcome to the show.
Well, glad to be here.
Well, we're just very happy to have you with us. Lavendar is going to start you off in talking about your book, The Adventure of Being Human.
Well, good.
Hey, hello, Jerry.
Hello.
My name is Lavendar, and I'm just really happy to... I received your book some time ago, and it's really fascinating. And so it looks like to me that you have really spent a lot of time and energy putting this information together. Let's start out by asking you, when you were younger, did you have any idea that you would be going in the direction that you're going now with all this metaphysical information?
None whatsoever.
Okay.
That's what made it so remarkable when it started happening, for sure.
Did you have like a life-changing experience where you just woke up one day and it said that you needed to look into all of the information, especially the Arantia book?
No, I just had a, back in the 60s, I had a very influential person in my life, you might say. I got with a bunch of folks and they introduced me to the Arantia book. And then shortly thereafter, I found it in a bookstore. And it took me about 6 years to get through it. The first time, so it was a kind of a slow process of just, accepting the reality of this. For your listeners, this is a 2,000-page book. It's like somebody giving you the complete works of Shakespeare, right? And almost like taking on a brand new language, because the whole book is just full of thousands and thousands of unique concepts. In my experience, you know, unique concepts in all of world literature. So it's like getting hit by this tidal wave, right? Slowly swimming back to the surface and realizing you've changed. It's changed you because of this contact and the enormity of the Urantia book.
Yes, I got the book back in 1980, and I think it took me till about 85 to finish it. Yeah,
yep.
So I know it's a... it's a laborious task, but boy, how fascinating is it. Can you tell us who wrote it and why?
Yes, see, this is still somewhat a matter of contention among different folks because, again, for your listeners who are not familiar with it, when you open your Urantia book and you go to the table of contents, all the authors, in other words, I would even have to say the beings who actually wrote the Urantia book are all extra human. They're given various names like Melchizedek or archangels wrote part of it. Also, beings that don't appear in like in the Bible and things. They just give them English names like perfectors of wisdom, life carriers. The beings who actually planted life on the earth here wrote that part of the Urantia book. So it's I suggest a lot of folks when they get a hold of a Urantia book. They just open to the table of contents, and it's like 65 pages, just the table of contents, but it gives a little outline of every chapter. And so if they look through this, some of it's pure theology, like the nature of God. Other, it's pure science, like the way that planets and stars are formed and so forth. Part of it is the history of our planet starting billions of years ago in enormous detail. And then the fourth book, the fourth section of the Urantia book is the life of Jesus, sometimes day to day. It's 760 pages of the life of Jesus, and so it has approximately 10 times the detail as the New Testament. So this, when you open your ration book, this is what you're in for. So I would just suggest going to the table of contents and read around in there and see just what piques your curiosity, see what tickles your fancy, and get into it that way.
You know, I can remember two things that really that made me giggle when I saw it, and that was the thought adjusters and the midway creatures.
Oh, yeah, right.
I thought those were real clever little sayings, thought adjusters and midway creatures.
Well, the whole idea of the thought adjuster of actually having a presence of God in our mind, which, a lot of religions say that. We have that small, still voice within us if we can only hear it, right, and pay attention to it. So, there's three papers on probably 30 pages on just the thought adjuster, the presence of God in our minds.
How about the midway creatures?
The midway creatures, they came about after Adam and Eve. I'm talking about that's the secondary midwayers. The primary midwayers are about 500,000 years old on the planet here. Do you remember a thing about the planetary prince?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right, a celestial being at 500,000 years ago, a celestial being came to the earth to kind of run things. And since he would be invisible, a pure spiritual being, he would be invisible to the aboriginal human beings. He had 50 men and 50 women as what he called his corporal, or living men and women, right, as his staff. And they themselves created, got together in what they called a non-sexual liaison, whatever that means, a kind of a spiritual liaison, and created the primary midwayers. And then later on, with 40,000 years ago, with Adam and Eve, they themselves created the secondary midwayers, came into existence. And it's a secondary midwayer who actually writes those all those papers on the life of Jesus.
Yes.
So we're just temporary.
We're
just temporarily here for our short lifetimes. The midwayers have been around for a long time.
What does the word Urantia actually mean?
That's just the spiritual. It doesn't have any meaning. It's just the name of our planet. It's, in other words, the Urantia book is just the celestial version, their vision of the history of our planet. So that's what the Urantia papers are. Just the, you might say, it's the Earth papers.
Okay. What is the essential teaching or the core message of the Urantia revelation?
If it's not too deep, I would like to go just basically into the four different sections of it.
Okay.
Yeah, the first section of the Urantia book is the overall creation, and there starts out with 50 pages on the nature of God. Has separate papers on the eternal Son and the infinite Spirit. So it has a trinity at the origin and beginning of everything, in the center of everything. And I think the major lesson of this first section is that the universe is created and then administered by a whole hierarchy of spiritual beings. In other words, it's not pantheism. God does not personally do everything. God actually shares his essence, his creativity, with all these personal beings right on down to us. And so there's like a head of a galaxy, and there's heads of the smaller parts of a galaxy, like a local universe. So that's the first section is an overall view of creation, no less. The second section is our local universe of about 4 million inhabited planets. This is giving you some idea of the scope and the size of the creation. And the second book, the second section on the local universe, goes into enormous detail. You remember of what happens to us when we die, this whole next phase of our eternal existence. It also introduces the head of a local universe, that's just a part of the galaxy, is what they call a creator son of God, Michael, and a creator daughter of God, or what we call Mother Spirit. And so it introduces these two creative beings, what we think of as roughly male and female, who are the head. They're hundreds of billions of years old, and they're the head of our local universe. The third section of the Urantia book is the history of the planet, Urantia, starting billions of years ago in the creation of the solar system. Gets into that. It talks about the way the planet was formed in 100 million year segments. At a certain time, you have beings called life carriers who actually come and start life on the planet. And then it goes into like the whole evolution of life, right down to the first human beings, and then the evolution and development of like civilization, government, society, culture, religion. So it comes right down to the times of Jesus. And then the fourth section of the Urantia book, about 760 pages here, my notes tell me. I don't have 760 pages on the life of Jesus in enormous detail, told by a being that was actually there at the time. In other words, it's not anything like the Bible or any other kind of religious paper that's been evolved over the years. This is the life of Jesus as told by a being who's actually there. So this is the, you might say, the literary claim of the Urantia book. It's 2,000 pages of very small little writing. This is the comprehensive claim, you might say, of the Urantia book.
Okay. Your book, The Adventures of Being Human, it has supplemental teachings that do not appear in the text of the Urantia book. And why is that, and how did this new material come about?
Okay, your listeners should know that the Urantia book, it's not as such a religion, but it's been published, I think it came out in 1955, and since then it's been published in, I think, over 12 languages now, probably 10 million or so copies around the world. It's not a religion, there's no church as such, a formal church. But all over the world, and especially in all the different countries with the different language and stuff, there's study groups. It's just people get together who are curious about this and want to talk about it, want to share it. And so that's also how I got started, is that about 15 years ago, I ran into a study group here in Marin County in California. We're just north of San Francisco. And we just got together. We spent several years we meet once a week and talk about it, and take one part of it at a time. And then about 1992, that's about 20 years ago, in various of these study groups all around the world, people started getting information. In other words, while they're meditating, they would just start getting information. It just occurs as thoughts in your mind that are not coming from your own personality. And so this is a whole new phenomenon, and we call it the teaching mission. So it started about 1992, and it spread all over the world. It got to our group, and we heard about it, and we didn't believe it either. We thought, well, this is ridiculous. It's not like the Urantia book isn't enormous and comprehensive enough. Now we got people all over coming out with new material. But about 12 years ago, a girl by the name of, or a lady by the name of Donna D'Angelo, who was doing this kind of, we call it transmitting, receiving, I guess other people would call it channeling, she came out to our group, and all of a sudden, just attending a number of these sessions with her and getting to know her, I became convinced that, number one, this was not part of her imagination. This is not coming from her personality. That she actually was transmitting or channeling a spiritual being. And so after a number of years passed and she had to leave and go somewhere else, I just took over 8 years ago. I took over this function for our group, our little study group. And so for 8 years now, I've been transmitting Michael and Mother Spirit. So that's how I got into it. And if your listeners want to, they can go to tmarchives.com. And so, as I say, we call this a teaching mission. That's the TM part. And a fellow by the name of Ron Besser, he started an archive of all over the world these various lessons that have been channeled or transmitted to us. So if your listeners go to TM Archives, they'll find approximately 5,500, over 5,000 of these lessons from all around the world. And I think you'll be surprised that this is something very new in humanity here now, where you have this kind of a thing happening all around the world, a very cohesive, together, knit together presentation of advanced truth and spirituality, all based in a sense, roughly based on the Urantia book. And that's the language we use, and that's the cosmology in which what I'm doing makes sense. Because to other people, you know, to a lot of people I know, it wouldn't make sense if I just said, would they say, well, what are you doing during your meetings? I say, well, I transmit or I channel Michael and Mother Spirit. To them, that would be absurd. But that is what we do.
Let me ask you, do you ever find that simultaneously at the same time that people from all over the world may get the same message on the same day in the same hour?
No, it does. It does. Not exactly. That's a very good question. It's kind of yes and no. There is this essential agreement between all these transmitter receivers, and that basic message of just the way that Michael and Mother Spirit, the way the spiritual community sees our situation here, is remarkably the same. So yes, in one way, but usually not the exact same words. It'll be every transmitter receiver has a slightly different slant on it. The way I put it is that the spiritual message is like pure white light, but it is fractured somewhat into different colors as it comes to different personalities. Some transmitters are more into a kind of a bhakti yoga, a thing of devotion. As it comes to me, it's more philosophical and psychological, historical, that sort of thing. So it is slightly changed as it comes to different people. The spiritual community, as they're transmitting this material, just uses all of that you are, you know. And so every individual will be slightly different, and it won't be word for word identical. But the similarity of the message is remarkable.
You know, that reminds me, when I was living in Cripple Creek, my friend Belva was writing letters for Shirley MacLaine's because she needed someone to write metaphysically the letters that she would get.
And, right.
And so she, over a period of 4 years, I think she had like 65,000 letters that she answered. But on one particular day, I went to pick up the mail, and I took it to Belva, and there were like 300 letters that day. And we started opening them, and they all were the same. And they came from all over the world, and they had a message, a dream. They'd all had a dream, and they wanted to, and they were told to share it with Shirley MacLaine. And we just sat there dumbfounded. We were opening the mail, and it was the same message over and over and over again. I'll never forget that. I mean, it was like... It was one of the, you talk about thought adjusters. The thought adjusters were working that day for sure.
Well, this is something that you just took the words right out of my mind. Because it says in the Urantia book that the thought adjusters, they're such a high spiritual presence. A lot of people mistake it. It's not what we normally think of as conscience. Because conscience is pretty much just what you're socially trained to do. Like, I thought sometimes even in like dictatorships like Hitler's Germany or Stalin's Russia, some of those people had no conscience because they were just trained that way. So what we mean by a thought adjuster, by God's presence in your mind, is more than just what normally people think of as conscience. And, of course, the Urantia book does state that God can put ideas, distinct, discrete ideas like you mentioned here, in people's minds.
Yes, absolutely. So tell us more a little bit about the title of the book, The Adventures of Being Human and What It Suggests, and tell us more about your personal adventure in writing this.
Jesse, my friend Byron Belitos, who edited and published the book, our website is called evolving-souls.org. Evolving-souls-org with a little hyphen in the middle there. Evolving-souls-org, and it's where your folks can go and pick up a lot of this material. The Adventure of Being Human, Byron and I, we finally realized, I think between us, we're trying to think of a title, that one of the main lessons that Michael and Mother Spirit teach is that God is in control, if not in every little thing we do. We're not always following God's will, but it is His intention. It is God's way of raising His children, is to put us down in the middle of an adventure. And we define an adventure by not always knowing what's coming next. I guess the most extreme example would be like mountain climbing, when you're out there hanging on your fingernails on the, you know, on the edge of a cliff. But just as we go about our daily life, I get up in the morning and have my breakfast. I have a job to go to. I don't know absolutely for certain I'm going to get there, or even what's going to happen there. In other words, life itself is this adventure. It's to a degree impenetrable. We can't always tell what's going to happen. And tragic events like what happened yesterday just show that for some folks, I mean, something right out of the blue, something they have absolutely nothing to do with, like geopolitics maybe, you know, just turned their life upside down. And so life is an adventure. And the adventure of being human, it's part of what Michael and Mother Spirit are saying. It was designed this way, as God designed it this way, is the best way to raise His children is to surround us with such an enormity of creativity, this whole world we're in, this whole universe we're in, that it encourages us to have this spirit of adventure is the way to approach life. It's almost the only way to approach life. And rather than running away from it in any way, we accept that it is an adventure, that we can't always know what is going to happen to us. We have to kind of wait moment by moment for that sometimes. But we can have this faith and this trust in the author of this whole adventure, in the creator of this adventure, and that it is for our own good, for our own soul growth. And that confidence, that faith we have, this is how we earn that faith, is by living the adventure. So it's the adventure of being human, and it's Michael and Mother Spirit's assurance that this is by God's plan. And it, you know, it gets rough at times. It's full of pain. It's full of uncertainty and anxiety. But it's also full of genuine accomplishment, genuine having. We have each other and so forth, you know. That's the adventure. Also, Mother and Michael Spirit, they gave a few lessons one time on, it'd be nice if when we're born, you know, if not even our parents, maybe our religious teachers or our school teachers, somebody could give us a owner's manual for being human. It's like when you get a car or a motorcycle, they give you an owner's manual. But we don't literally get one of those. So to a degree, these lessons in the adventure of being human, these lessons they give, and especially the questions and answers, the way they answer questions, it becomes this owner's manual for being human. It's like what a human being is, so we can see ourselves and see each other from their point of view.
Yeah, that really makes a lot of sense. You know, I was thumbing through your book, and I came across something called the Lucifer Rebellion. Would you expand on this a little bit and tell our listening audience what the Lucifer Rebellion is and how it relates to what's happening now?
Certainly. Again, we're going back to, there's a number of papers in the Urantia book dealing with this. As I said, the Urantia book talks about a cosmos, when you look up there at those starry heavens at night, right, that is actually created and then organized and administered by celestial beings, by high spiritual beings. And so, by say, Michael and Mother Spirit are head of a local universe of millions of planets. You get down to what they call a local system. Our local system here is about 600 planets. And the head of it was a high celestial being, a very high spiritual being called Lucifer. And he was just remarkable for just the brilliance of him. That's why he got that name, Lucifer. And a number of years ago, about 200,000 years ago, he decided to rebel against Michael and Mother Spirit and God. In other words, they say this simply occurred in his mind. He's a personal being. He has free will like we do. He got this idea in his mind that, first of all, there is no overall God to creation. That's just something that Michael and Mother Spirit invented to control him, right? And so even though Michael and Mother Spirit are his parents, in other words, he's their son, they actually created him, because he has this free will, he decided to rebel against them. And a number of planets in this our local system here, 37 particular planets, they joined the rebellion. The spiritual leaders of our planet, was one of them, joined this rebellion. So 200,000 years ago, there was this Lucifer rebellion that took place. And the result of it is that the higher authorities, you might say, they let this run for a number of years just to see where everybody could understand where they stood with respect to the rebellion. Then they just stepped in and squashed it because they had the power to do so. And our planet, ever since then, we don't have a celestial being here on the planet running things. And so our planet, along with 36 others of our local system here, we went into, might say, spiritual default and quarantine, you know, so the rebellion wouldn't spread. And so we've been without a celestial being on the planet here running things, developing our civilization and all this sort of thing. So we're still very primitive. We just simply haven't evolved as what we were supposed to normally do. So that's the result of because of the Lucifer rebellion, our planet went into default. We lost our spiritual rudder, you might say, and we very quickly reverted to a kind of a savage, very primitive type of existence. 200,000 years here later, it was only very, very slowly did our civilization evolve. Like, what is Egypt? Egypt was, what, about 5,000 years ago? We're a normal planet would have all the civilization and the cultures of a whole entire planet are brought along together under direction, under spiritual direction. On our planet here now, we still have, well, like what's happening over in Syria. We have tens of thousands of people being killed in a civil war. 60 years ago, we had tens of millions of people die in a world war. So this is not the way it's supposed to be. Our whole planet, is going into this kind of default, and had, you know, just reverted to very savage, primitive ways for most of these last 200,000 years. This is also why Michael, as Jesus, 2,000 years ago, he came here in a sense to turn things around on this planet. And as we know, in the last 2,000 years, we've probably advanced more culturally and in terms of civilization than we did in almost tens of thousands of years before that.
Yes, that's very true. Well, that takes us to, you know, the Atlantean times. Does Urantia mention Atlantis in the book? I don't remember.
Not at all. There is no mention of that whatsoever. Not as a independent civilization like that that flourished and then was lost through some natural calamity.
Okay. Well, when you were writing this book, tell me what you started experiencing on a personal level within your job or your your relationships with your family? How did this? I mean, did your family approve of what you were doing, or did they make fun of you, or were they with you all the way?
Oh no, I just have a surviving sister now. My parents are gone, but my parents were just kind of you might say vaguely interested in the Urantia book, and we talk about it a bit. My sister, who's still living, is very supportive. She enjoys all these things. I should say the adventure of being human is about 90% of it is what you would call transmitted or channeled material. And if I could go into that very slightly, when I'm channeling this material, I can understand, and it makes sense as I'm saying, as I'm transmitting Michael or Mother Spirit, but I can't, in one way, I can't anticipate what they're going to say. I have to be in such a state of mind that I just say immediately what comes into my mind. In other words, I'm just transmitting it. I can't react with it, or that would be me, and it would just stop. And if your listeners want to, they can go to this TM Archives I mentioned, tmarchives.com. Go to the audio. You know, at the top there, you'll see a bunch of little hang-down menus. Just go to when it says video audio. They can click on audio and listen to me giving these transmissions of Michael and Mother Spirit over the last couple years. Now, I've been doing this for 8 years. I probably have about 350 to 400 of these lessons that I've been giving. For a while, it was once a week. Now, it's about once a month. And I also do a Lightline teleconference, which a couple dozen people tune into, and I also transmit for those. So this is a very highly, it's not, I don't go into any kind of trance state. If the telephone rings or somebody, if I'm transmitting to a group here and somebody knocks on the door, I can go and talk to them and come back and just go right back into it. But initially it takes me about an hour of meditation just by myself to kind of settle down out of my own life and, you know, tune into this. But it's not like I hear a voice or something physical in my mind and then say it out loud. It's much more instantaneous than that. I have to be able to just park myself in space and say whatever comes into my mind, even though it's not coming from my own personality. So that's what transmitting is all about. And this book, in other words, 90% of the adventure of being human, I didn't write it. It's just something that I transmitted into a recording device, and then I have some friends help transcribe it. And so, again, if your listeners go to TM Archives, they can just click on, you know, the Marin County TM group, Teaching Mission group, and there they'll see several hundred of my lessons. And also there's a group of people sitting around, so there's questions and answers. People can ask Michael or Mother Spirit most anything that occurs to them.
That's great. I know that when I received the crystal quartz crystal book, A Celestial Point of View, that's the way it was transmitted to me, and I didn't even remember writing it, and so I never really lectured on it because I didn't remember writing it. But it went far and fast really quick. It was part of a movement back in the early 80s when the crystals really became, you know, the thing to have.
Right.
Yeah. Me and three others, we wrote something the same two-week period, and we didn't even know each other. We found this out later, that it was given to us, and each one of us had a different piece of the story about what quartz crystal. Yeah.
Well, this,
it was
this
always
is where,
amazing to me how that worked.
Well, this is the same with me. When I first started transmitting, all of a sudden my mentor, Donna, has gone back. She went over to Oakland and started a group there, and I've got six people. I used to have an older fellow, Charlie, come down from Sacramento, 65 miles every Monday evening just to, you know, and he stayed with me all these 8 years, and he right up to 2 weeks before he died, I think at the age of near, he was near 80. He was... I think up to 2 weeks before he died, he was still making our meetings here. And the same thing is true with me. When it's all over, I just have a very vague memory of a few things that because, you know, as we're talking here, I have a sense of a train of thought, you know, that I'm keeping with you. And I have a pretty good memory of what we talked about. But after transmitting sometimes for an hour and answering questions, and I have very little memory of it. And so when I go back on, when I get it transcribed, I have a friend that transcribes it, and then I just edit it, you know, before it goes out. I'm encountering it. That's when I really get to relate to it myself.
Oh, I totally identify with that. Absolutely. So, Ariel, are
you
there?
The way I put it, one way is, how can you anticipate what some illimitable spiritual being wants to say through you?
Yeah,
you know, it's very humbling in that sense, because, and at the same time, I know that I can't do this. I just can't sit down and give a lesson for a half an hour and then answer questions, you know, from everybody, every kind of wild, you know, a metaphysical, spiritual question you can imagine, right? I can't even begin to do that. So that's why it's kind of valid for me, you know, inside.
So let me ask you, do you think you planned this before you were born, that you would come and do this?
No.
Okay.
That, by the way, you know, this is the one question that's probably been asked more. I think it was asked the very first time I took over the duties, you know, being a transmitter receiver. One of the very first questions that was asked, and is also, it's one of the most frequently asked questions, is about reincarnation. And I've been told that most of the world, at least way over half the world, believes in reincarnation. But from the standpoint of the Urantia book, and from these hundreds of lessons that I've transmitted from Michael and Mother Spirit, there's pretty much a refutation of reincarnation.
Well, that's where I disagree with Urantia.
Exactly, right.
Yeah. Many of our Starseed listeners are really into the study of reincarnation.
Right.
Ariel, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Well, Jerry, it's been really, really nice talking to you. I'm going to turn it over to Ariel now, and maybe she'll have some things to ask you, and we have a switchboard with callers that may want to ask some questions.
Okay.
So thank you for being our guest.
Oh, for sure. Thank you.
Well, Jerry, I have got to ask you then, do you think that the information that was presented through the Urantia book was filtered with a purpose? In other words, the evidence and the documentation on reincarnation, it's not a question of, do you believe in it? It's, do you accept it? Because I've read a lot of accounts where, you know, children are born and they know things from a past life, and it's verifiable. So do you think that from the sources that you talk about that seem to be refuting that, is there a purpose or a design so that, because obviously if I mess up this time, I'll just straighten it out later, you know,
right.
Use it as an excuse or something. Why do you think that's not supported in the book?
Yes. This is something I say that Michael and Mother Spirit, through me and through others, have been asked a number of times. And first of all, they point out that the whole history of the theory or the understanding of reincarnation, it itself has gone through an enormous evolution over the years. The first accounts of it in Veda India were a sense about the fact that what we call a personality is the fundamental essence of who you are. It's created by God, and it's unique amongst all personal beings are created by God, their essence. And whether you're a spiritual being, you're a human being, or whatever. And so we're talking about this essence of who you uniquely are. I think that's to begin with, right? And this is something that the first forms of reincarnation, it's funny because they were very prescient. Now, you can say it's because of the thought adjuster in their mind, the presence of God was giving them these ideas, and they could just understand it as best they could in those primitive times that you came up through. Remember that the first ideas of reincarnation, you came up through a whole series of evolution of animal and so forth until you became a human being. And if you really messed up in this life, if you're evil or whatever have you, you might even actually, a lot of mythology actually has you going back and reliving other phases of being an animal. Or shall we say you were very cruel to you're a man and you're very cruel to a woman in this life. You would have to come back in the next life as a woman. And there's the fundamental theory of reincarnation is that there is a cosmic justice. There is a God-created cosmic justice to our lives here, that what we are experiencing has meaning and value and a certain kind of justice to it. Now, I say it's very prescient because have you ever heard that phrase that embryology recapitulates phylogeny?
I can't even say it.
Okay, as embryos, we start out as a fertilized egg, a one cell, a living one cell being, right?
Uh-huh.
With, of course, all the DNA from both our mother and father are forming those chromosomes and things, right? And as we, within our mother, as all through embryology, as we are embryos, we recapitulate the evolution of life. In other words, at a certain time, we're about the size of a little peanut, and you can, unless you're an expert, you cannot distinguish a human embryo from what will become a frog or what will become a chimpanzee. In other words, right within our mothers, right within embryology, we recapitulate the evolution of life, the phylums, the way that life is divided, into shellfish and then vertebrates and then primates and so forth. We have all gone through that. Every single one of us has recapitulated that. So in that sense, reincarnation is true. Also the fact that when that sperm and egg come together, we are benefiting from the whole evolution of life on the planet. In other words, two parents, four grandparents, eight great grandparents, so forth, right?
Mm-hmm.
They've noted this in Mozart and some of these musical families where hundreds of children have this enormous, amazing musical ability. In other words, when that sperm and egg come together, we are inheriting. This is the old idea of heredity, the enormous amount of not only, shall we say, blue eyes and tall or whatever, resembling our parents. Heredity is extremely, extremely more detailed than what was up until very recent times known. And so, again, the whole idea of reincarnation, when that sperm and egg get together, we are inheriting enormous, enormous characteristics from all of our progenitors, And so there's a lot in reincarnation that is true. But the fact that our personality, who we uniquely are, did not have a previous existence. That's what Michael and Mother Spirit teach, is that God does not have to repeat himself. Our personality comes directly from God, and we start here. Now, again, like reincarnation, the Urantia book talks about in enormous detail of all of our lives to come and how they are linked together. Now, it's our personality and our soul here, that we evolve our soul from our life experience, that does continue. And we do go through a number of changes as we, go across the universe, in our life, all of our lives to come. And so reincarnation is true in that sense also. They're just saying it starts here.
Well, that might be a little metaphoric because, yes, each time you start kind of with a clean slate as far as your a new personality, but it is a composite of what you are bringing from past lifetimes. So it could be just a matter of semantics as to, yeah, this is, you know, it's the first time that you've been Jerry Lane.
No, no, they're saying that that's not the case. In other words, the personality that we are, the essence that I am, right,
uh-huh,
is created by God at the moment a sperm and egg come together. In other words, it's created there. There is no previous existence, because they say that sense of reincarnation, shall we say, having successive human lives, is like trying to get back into your mother's womb. It's like your first life here. When you die here, you have a whole universe to go out and explore. You are immediately, you know, when you regain consciousness, you are on another. I can't emphasize how many chapters they go into, how many enormous detail they go into about what happens to you when you die, but you never come back here. You've got a whole universe to go out and explore. You would never come back to your planet of nativity. And it's not a matter of semantics. They actually say that no, when you die, when you regain consciousness, you are on a very specific world. They talk about the kind of body you have, the kind of mind and soul you have, how you relate to everybody else who's gone on before you. There's no reason for you ever to have a second human life. You've got, you know, hundreds and thousands of years ahead of you of all kind of changes as you become more and more spiritual.
Well, according to...
In other words, it's a direct refutation of reincarnation. It's not just a matter of semantics.
And then according to the book, then... has the essence of Michael only incarnated one time?
Yes, right. Michael only incarnated as a human being one time, as Jesus of Nazareth.
What about Sananda?
Who is Sananda?
Pardon?
Who is that?
It was a being that many people believe was the essence of Jesus, that was here for a short time again.
I see. Yes. Again, there's a direct refutation of that. Michael,
mm-hmm,
the Creator Son of God, Michael. See, again, the Urantia book has him being 400 billion years old. The Creator Son of almost 4 million planets now, and with 10 million planet evolved worlds in prospect. And so Michael only had this one human life as Jesus. And at that time, God actually put this requirement on him. And as a Creator Son, he actually had to live the life of one of his own creations. Like Mother Spirit will never do this, but Michael himself had to do this. But when he completed his life as Jesus, his whole status kind of changed. In other words, he won't have to ever do this again. And I've transmitted Michael saying this is why, even though he's hundreds of billions of years old, he's intimate with, you know, you imagine just the trillions of human beings on all these planets that he's known, personally known, part of their life. He's part of our life. This one human life he actually had himself was so precious. He even talks about the crucifixion, about how he stayed with it up to the very end, you know. So this is just another whole presentation of what a human being is, how we get started, and then what's in prospect for us.
What do they say, or have they said anything in transmissions to you about the extraterrestrials, and what part do they play in the hierarchy?
No. There's no mention in the entire Urantia book, or in, as far as I know, in any of these thousands of lessons that have been transmitted, you know, on the Teaching Mission archive. You can go over; it's an archive of all the Teaching Mission lessons and questions and answers. The only thing they say is that there are civilizations just immeasurably more advanced than we are. Our little local system here of about 600 planets, we're number 606. In other words, there are 605 other planets here which are much more older and much more advanced technologically than us. So they don't say it's impossible. They don't say it's not happening. They just don't address that whatsoever.
I wonder why. I think this is just my own personal thing.
The implication is that when you talk about when the Urantia book gets into the what they call the angels of progress, there's tens of thousands, there's millions of celestial beings on the planet here with us. We each have a guardian angel. That's not just some figment of the Bible. Each of us has a guardian angel that helps, you know, us through life. There's all kind of legions of angels doing, you know, angels of civilizations and so forth. In other words, our planet here has a huge spiritual component to it, of spiritual beings, different kind of angels, archangels, life carriers. They're all still on the planet, these midwayers we talked about. And so any kind of ET or extraterrestrial, this is my own feeling, would have to be in perfectly accord with the whole spiritual hierarchy of the planet and of this local system and everywhere else. In other words, there's not going to be any beings land here and suddenly decide that we're yummy food. Remember, like Independence Day, they had a movie about extraterrestrials coming here and trying to take over, you know, and destroy us. To my mind, that's impossible because of the spiritual hierarchy in the universe.
Well, we have, I mean, through Lavendar's, you know, 35 years of direct contact with the Pleiadians, would agree that they will allow us to fall down or make mistakes as a civilization, but when it comes to destroying us, that's where they draw the line. And, you know, I'm feeling like it could be that some of the, quote, you know, celestial guardians that book refers to could include, you know, beings from such high dimensions, whether they're extraterrestrial or beings of light. They all must adhere to universal laws.
Yeah, well, I follow all that. Exactly. You know, to me, that's very much in agreement. Like I say, it just doesn't come up. It's not mentioned one way or the other. They don't say it's impossible. But they do say that some human beings who once lived here are now back on the planet. And I should say that according to the teaching mission that I'm a part of, this all started in 1992, of people all around in these Urantia study groups starting to transmit beings from spiritual beings. That's because this Lucifer rebellion was adjudicated. In other words, a kind of a spiritual quarantine our planet was kept in. This is purely spiritual, and we're relating to spiritual beings coming and going. We were in a kind of quarantine. Lucifer and all those fallen angels, you might say, that kept with him, were adjudicated. They were simply erased. In other words, they actually are no more. And it inaugurated a whole spiritual kind of renaissance on this planet. Now, that's what a lot of people in all different kind of spiritual disciplines are feeling now, is that our planet is indeed undergoing a spiritual renaissance, that they kind of a spiritual evolution that Michael, Mother Spirit, they say this is unstoppable in spite of some of the warfare still hanging on and crime and all this sort of thing. The planet is absolutely irrevocably evolving, you know, and we have to kind of get with that evolution. So in that sense, it's very positive what's happening in their view of things.
Right. Well, it's like a birthing process, and it's not without pain, not without labor. But
right.
The end result is going to be a world with a much higher level of spirituality, you know, unconditional love, and the whole thing that we've been talking about for, you know, for years.
Right.
Where we are entering, well, the Age of Aquarius officially started, and now that, you know, that we've been in transition for a long time, but yes, it is going to happen. It is happening, and the powers that were are kind of hanging on and kicking and screaming and trying you know, throwing everything that they can think of, but it's not going to make any difference because
right.
we are going to a higher and better civilization.
Yeah, you have that. You have that thorny issue of free will, right? It's,
well, right, right.
And that's,
I mean,
something that that's part of the teachings of Michael and Mother Spirit, is that the whole spiritual hierarchy, the whole spiritual community, not only surrounding our planet here, but everywhere, does recognize and does respect that whole issue of free will. In other words, they're not going to come. There's not going to be some huge spiritual force come down and suddenly solve everything for us. Michael Jesus was the greatest teacher in that sense. But another thing in the Urantia and in our own group, our own understanding of things, what we call this correcting time, the teaching mission, it's not all it has to do with Urantia. In other words, every religion, according to our view of things, every person, every human being has these great spiritual presences within them, not only the what we call the thought adjuster, the thing that can give you the good thoughts, the presence of God. Christianity recognizes Mother Spirit's Holy Spirit as part of us. Jesus has taught lessons on his Spirit of Truth. Is also, in other words, we have these spiritual influences within us, and it's not so much that there aren't any more evil spirits on the earth. They're long gone as of the time of Jesus. But you have the persistence of culture. You have the persistence of lack of civilization. You know, you have constant warfare that came right on down to the Second World War, where tens of millions of people died, you know, killing each other and so forth, you know, mm-hmm. our World War. That is slowly tapering off. In other words, the world is slowly turning to democracy. It is slowly turning to more peaceful ways of settling our differences. So that is happening, but there's also this statement, there are no more evil spirits as such on the earth. Now,
there's a lot of people that might debate that, even if they're not in the same context that you're referring to. But
sure, yeah, right.
It's going kicking and screaming, but there is still, we're all faced with different levels of wickedness. And, you know, again, that's where your free will comes in, where you choose not to sink to that level. Instead, you take a step up.
Exactly.
I think
there's some statement in the Urantia book that the devil gets credit for what is an ordinary, just shall we say, a lot of greed and selfishness and self-centeredness. Egomaniacal behavior, you know, the devil gets credit for a lot of just, shall we say, basic human weaknesses.
Well, again, it's kind of a symbolism. I personally don't think that there's a guy with horns and a tail, but it's the presence of, or the absence of light in places, in people. The absence.
Exactly, right.
So what, I'm curious, what do Michael and Mother Spirit say or think about how man civilization subverted their teaching from the time of Jesus?
Not so much, except that they go an awful lot into the, first of all, their definition of religion. Now, again, this is why you have this 2,000-page Urantia book, because it has not only its own cosmology and science and everything else, it has its own philosophy. And their view of religion is every single individual's inner relationship to the God within them, you know, this presence of God within them. Your relationship with God, second of all, your relationship to this, the fatherhood of God, and then the sonship of all human beings, you know, all the men and women, and it's your relationship to God within you, and then your relationship to other people. That is the essence of religion. Now, that is there's nothing wrong with people getting together and sharing those experiences and forming what we call churches, right? But when they get into organized religion, when you get into the manifestations of people getting together and creating religions, and then they have made the statement that all through our history, especially since not only since the Jesus times, but ever since going back to Egyptian times, whenever have you, a great majority of what people called themselves as religious people have simply been politicians. In other words, people who were interested in and cultivated, you might say, pure worldly power over other people. That is what accounted for most of this terrible things that happened in the name of religion.
Right.
These are just individuals. These are just individuals who were essentially politicians. They were just interested in worldly power and riches and, you know, so forth, and controlling all their followers, whether you were a pharaoh or whomever, you know, of whatever religion. And
right.
We still have so-called religious people on the earth today teaching that, shall we say, God wants you to go out and kill other people. I mean, that is actually taught and used as a justification for murder.
I got a real huge nerve on that one, because, you know, all the, you know, the holy wars and the crusades and this, you know, to go out and kill in the name of Jesus. I'm just thinking, like, oh, this is not at all what his message was, and it is so opposite of that.
Exactly.
What about, I mean, you know, and then the persecution of women through down through the years in Catholicism, even to the point of branding, you know, witchcraft and things like that. That, I mean, that's all through this power lust of, as you say, politicians. It's a very good way to put it.
The Urantia book, when it talks about the evolution of society and organization, it starts on tribal level and things, and it talks about there's whole things on the relationships of the sexes and the way that almost universally on a tribal level, and for most of the history of humanity on the earth now, they say that people have been around, although extremely crude, you know, savage, primitive people. Women have pretty much universally been treated as possessions. In other words, the father controlled his daughters and did with what he wanted with them, you know, sold them or traded them off or... I remember there was a Joan Baez song. I remember, "Heart is the fortune of all womankind. She's always controlled, she's always confined. Controlled by her parents until she's a wife, a slave to her husband the rest of her life." Now, that's Joan Baez singing some 16th or century, you know, pretty recent times. The thing about the Urantia book is that there's so much in the Urantia book in the story of Jesus. There's nothing at all in the Bible about the 300 women, the women's group, the 300 or more of the women's group that he taught. Probably Jesus had more to do with and what he taught and the way he actually showed his followers, and they were just totally shocked at sometimes he would even talk to women, because in those days, if you were a respectable Jewish man, you did not talk to women in public. You know, you didn't acknowledge them. They were some kind of subhuman being, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so with Jesus, that's something that would delight your listeners, that part of his life in which he probably did more to elevate the status of women than almost anybody that came before or since.
Yeah, and then, of course, when man-made Christianity occurred, then they just backpedaled on all of that.
Exactly.
Like, oh, forget that. And what about the role of Mary Magdalene?
She's just part of that. She was just part of a very leading person in that women's group. See, the Urantia book has so much in about Jesus's life. The thing that hit me most, more than anything else, is when Jesus was on 15 or 16, I forget exactly when, but they had become a very prosperous middle-class family. Joseph was the head foreman of a big project. He got killed, a derrick, and one of these huge derrick collapsed. Joseph got killed when Jesus was only like 14 or 15 or so, And all of a sudden, he's the father of seven younger brothers and sisters. And there's no mention of that in the Bible at all, the fact that for Jesus' entire life, he was the oldest son of seven other brothers and sisters of Mary's, you know, Mary's and Joseph's younger children. So when the girls grew up, they had to come to him, you know, with their spouses to get permission to get married. Some of his brothers are mentioned in the Bible, but those are considered spiritual brothers, because as far as I know, basic Christianity still considers Mary to have been a virgin throughout her entire life. So here we have Jesus being a father, 16 years old, all of a sudden being the head of a family, and of course without Joseph there, I mean they went to a total destitute, penniless state, you know, in very short order, and the way Jesus actually had to take care of that family until they were of enough of an age that he could actually leave him and set about his ministry, that's nowhere in the Bible.
Mm. Right. In the book, do they not mention Jesus' own children?
No, he never had children. Again,
we're going to have to disagree on that point as well.
Exactly right. I remember who was it? Norman Brown wrote a novel recently about he getting with Mary Magdalene, and what was that novel called? They made a movie of it. I forget the name of it, but.
You mean the Da Vinci Code?
Yeah, the Da Vinci Code. The Urantia book just says that a number of times he told his followers that being a son of being who, and not only who he was, but what he was, it was not incumbent upon him to have a family. But that was there's absolutely nothing wrong with. As a matter of fact, the Urantia book says a number of different times there's absolutely nothing wrong. everything right about human sexuality, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that those who see sexuality as such, as anything wrong with human sexuality as such, are just really some kind of poor, crippled souls, you know, that can't comprehend it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about it, almost every primitive religion has always had its followers either a virgin birth or, you know, Zeus, you know, Zeus gives rise to Aphrodite or whatever, you know. In other words, that's almost a common thing about the origins of the heads of religions. Always had these, like Buddha had this miraculous birth and all that sort of thing.
Right, yeah, the Immaculate Conception, and that you know, just to prove your divinity, but. I mean, I've read the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, and I have to say that I believe it,
uh-huh.
And that they had children, they were married, and after Jesus was crucified, Mary Magdalene carried on his teachings. I mean, it's all over the south of France. I mean, and we've been there and we've seen it and we've walked the same path and steps. So
that's marvelous. That's great.
I really, I mean, to me, you know, in my little, you know, third dimensional brain, if you're a being like that and you're on the earth and you are walking in human form, I would want the bloodline to continue, and because the time was all too brief, 33 years,
right.
It's all too brief. So to me, it would have been a wise thing to procreate, to keep the bloodline on the planet. And there's just tons of supporting evidence on that.
Right.
But actually, Jerry, we do have a caller with a question for you, and I would like to, if it's okay with you, open up the switchboard for questions.
Oh, for sure. Let's do it.
Okay. Well, first off, we are going to be talking to Ralph. Hello, Ralph. You're on the air.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes,
yes.
I can.
Oh, thank you. Very interesting show. And I appreciate you taking my call. But Jerry, I disagree with you on quite a few points here, but it's very interesting, though, the Urantia book. And I've done a little bit of kind of investigation here, and I'm confused on one thing. The book, was written by angels. Is that correct?
It was written by about 30 different kinds of beings.
Okay.
Some of them are of origin in our local universe here. Other ones are out from paradise. In other words, paradise origin beings. The origin of life on the Earth planet was actually written. Those parts are actually written by the life carriers who actually started life here about 3.5 billion years ago.
Okay, would they be considered extraterrestrials?
Yes. In other words, they came from the constellation level of our local universe. They have their own little laboratories where they experiment with different kinds of life and stuff.
Okay. Do you believe we are, the beings on this planet are actually sparks of divinity? In other words, spirits having human experience here?
The fundamental reality in the Urantia book, by the way, if it's okay, let me mention, go to tmarchives.com, tmarchives.com. Go to, it's paper. In TM Archives is the entire Urantia book. The entire Urantia book is in there, right?
Right.
So go to paper 112, 112, and it's called Personality Survival. And so TM Archives,
okay.
Urantia book, paper 112, Personality Survival. That is the most comprehensive definition of what a human being is. In other words,
okay.
Our personality is not of this world in a way. Our personality is totally changeless. We always be who we are, but through our human life, we acquire a soul of worldly experience. But yes, in one way, we are essentially a kind of a spiritual being with this physical body, with this mind.
Okay.
But also we have creative. We are creative beings. That's why we're a spiritual being. We're a creative being. We're living,
okay.
Co-creating our reality.
All right. There's a site called ubhoax.org. I've done some extensive reading on what they say about the Urantia book, and they actually kind of describe it as a hoax, and give. Quite a bit of dissertation on why it is. But,
exactly right.
My question, though, is, are you familiar with MK Ultra?
With who?
MK Ultra, a program run by the government.
No.
At any rate, okay. Well, my question to follow with that is, there've been a lot of channelers and people who have come through with information from. The spirit world, I suppose you may call it, and even from beings who are not necessarily in spirit, but have the ability to transmit their thoughts telepathically, and people will transcribe that information. Just the internet is just full of them. And my question has always been about these things is, how do you know that the information you're getting is from beings or entities or spirits or however you want to consider them who actually have mankind's interest at heart and instead are coming from a nefarious agenda and from a dark side, so to speak, and have come through with these informations, this kind of information through different channelers and maybe through yourself.
Yeah, exactly. By the way, this is you're putting your finger right on a very critical thing there. What to make of all this? I mean, again, you go to you pick up the Urantia book, and it says it was all created by extraterrestrial or by extra human beings, right? How do we know it's not the work of the devil that is so? Because it is so brilliant, it is so comprehensive, and it covers so many human disciplines, everything from philosophy to science to theology to history to on and on and on, right? This is something I think every individual has to decide for themselves. It's like how do you know that what I'm either the greatest egomaniac in the world claiming that I'm transmitting Christ Michael and Mother Spirit, or just maybe I'm sincere, but it's totally self-deluded. This is something that the material itself, to me, has to stand on its own. No matter what I claim or what anybody else claims that is the origin of this, it's between you and the material. Now, there's another thing. When I first started getting into the Rancho book about 45 years ago, it was a very rare thing. Now there's something, another, I'll give you another website here. It's called ubwebsites.com. In other words, it's a website of websites. When you go to ubwebsites.com, there's 300 websites now dealing with the Urantia book. And there's about 10 of those websites that deal with the Urantia books do not believe in it at all and have their own refutation of the Urantia book. And when my book is available on Amazon.com, well, the last I checked on Amazon.com, I guess we sold about 800,000 copies or so. It was running about 15-2. In other words, 15 people found it absolutely amazing. They just loved the book. It was a great moving thing in their life. And the other two, one that said it was spiritual drivel and sentimental fluff. So there you are.
Okay. Well, I just have one little last question. Are you a member of or been associated with any secret organizations such as the Freemasons?
No, I have. I went to regular college back in Ohio. I was 3.5 years in the Marine Corps. I was a platoon commander in the Marine Corps for 3.5 years. And then that's about the only organizations, in a sense, I've belonged to.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's been a very interesting conversation. And
You can go to the TM Archives and .com, and they actually have the Urantia book right there. And like I say,
okay,
that one chapter on personality survival is really interesting, isn't it? It's like, what happens to you when you die?
Okay, well, thank you very much. Have a nice night.
Thanks, Ralph. Bye-bye. So, you know, I think that in the end, like, as you said, you know, it's up to the individual. And when you read something, regardless of what the source is, if it resonates in your soul, as Lavendar always says, truth knows its own source.
Right.
And, you know, there may be parts that would resonate with one person and other parts that would not resonate with that person. But in the very end, everyone has to decide for themselves, just like you said. And yes, I do believe that God is all that is. Everything that is, its totality, that's what God is. And it is about love, and it is about white light and all that, but it's the totality of everything. And since we are part of the totality of everything, would you not agree that we are all a little micron flash of light that is part of God? We are connected in that way. Don't you agree?
Yes, this is the thing of the fatherhood of God. The Rancho book puts it of God has a personality circuit. In other words, God is the God. First of all, they say the word God applies to a personal being. In other words, not universal energy or matter or even just consciousness, pure consciousness itself. God is a personal being, and he's a creator of personality. In other words, he creates all of our personalities, of every trillions upon trillions, even different kinds of beings, angels, Melchizedeks, life carriers, creator. He actually created, you know, like Christ Michael and Mother Spirit. And we are all tied through that we all have this quality of personality that is directly tied to him. In other words, he's experiencing everything we're experiencing. Now, I think again, there's a lot of theology that it's part of God's omnipresence and omniscience, right? He's everywhere, and he's all-knowing and omnipotent, all-powerful. these are just his attributes. These are the attributes of deity. And the Urantia book just adds that one of sharing. In other words, God's desire and ability is to share his personhood with all of us. In that sense, all personal beings even have a rough kind of equality. I guess in Christianity they say God is no respecter of persons. That means that all personal beings created by God have a kind of equality to them. And it would really be nice if we could recognize this in each other, especially on the human level here.
Right.
I mean, there's no way it can be in God's will that, shall we say, we kill or torture or hurt each other. That cannot possibly be God's will, because it'd be one of his children hurting another. That's not his way.
Right. And that is where we are moving, in that direction. And I'm going to be repeating myself here, but you probably haven't heard the show that I said this before, so I'll just say it again, that obviously the balance between the masculine and the feminine concepts has been distorted with, you know, overly dominant masculine energy, and as we were talking about, you know, the feminine being repressed, but it is within the feminine where there is creativity and artistry and compassion and unconditional love and feeling of family and unity. And when those qualities are brought back to full level of health and balance with the masculine, then there won't be any more war, because we will learn how to really know that we are all brothers and sisters, and we are all of the same human family.
A lot of what Mother Michael's, when you pick up the Adventure of Being Human, like I say, it's like the owner's manual. It's like the workshop manual, the owner's manual for being human. They talk on, they go into a, they kind of redefine a lot of terms, like what it is to be, what they mean by personality. It's not like your high school yearbook, you know, the personality P to the, you know, and princess. They talk about your fundamental reality is coming from God. We are also endowed with, it's part of us, a creative spirit. In other words, as I'm sitting here, as you're listening to me, as you look around, wherever you are co-creating that reality. It doesn't mean that, shall we say, you're the chair you're sitting on or the room you're in. It's not an illusion. You're not totally creating that. It's not, you know, you're not God. It's real. But the meaning and the value it has for you, this is you. This is your soul. This is the value and meaning that you are giving to your life, to other people. You are co-creating your own reality. And this is the greatest cause of warfare and strife and stuff between people, is that people don't realize that what they are taking for objective reality, say a racist, I've known some racists, and when they see another person, they're not just seeing a little old lady or a little old man or something that maybe cut them off in traffic. No, it's that so-and-so racist kind of view of someone. They're not seeing a total person there. They're seeing some kind of stereotype.
Right.
And that's the main thing, is that Michael and Mother Spirit in this book, by getting us to recognize the complex beings we are, you know, personality with creative spirit, co-creating our reality, we take responsibility for it. And this is what you see, this lack of responsibility, these people seeing others, shall we say, different races, different cultures. Right now we have a cultural battle where some cultures are saying it's perfectly legitimate, even your duty, to kill other people of a different, simply other human beings of a different culture. That's your duty, to go out and kill them. You know, when you have that kind of lack of responsibility for the very way they're sincere. I mean, that's the trouble. They're very sincere in this.
That's based on the concepts of separatism and exclusion, and those are the walls that are coming down.
Exactly.
You know, whether it's organized religion, it's like, okay, you know, if you belong to a certain denomination of church, and you're the ones that are the chosen ones and the golden ones, and anyone that's not part of your little club, they're the bad guy,
right.
And that kind of mentality is on the way out. the one of exclusion and separation, and that includes the balance of masculine and feminine and the importance of bringing those things to balance to bring about this unity.
Right.
And
well, in a lot of our cultures here, it's the males have enjoyed thousands of years now of this kind of superiority and this ability to just completely dominate another human being. And this is where, again, the Urantia book, on when it talks about the whole evolution of humankind, I don't mean physically, I mean, but from the time that the very first human beings kind of achieved full humanhood and what that means, right? That was almost a million years ago. In other words, we're looking at a million years now of this kind of sexual inequality because of, it. First of all, incessant warfare, absolutely incessant warfare. Look at our own history here. Look at the constant warfare between the tribes, like the Indian tribes here, or you go back in the Bible, and that constant warfare that after a million years of warfare that led right up to the Second World War and bringing the sun right down on the earth to incinerate people, right? That million years of warfare was the main thing in a sense that men, in a sense, were there to defend, to learn how to not only kill but even to face the prospect of being killed in combat. I mean, that was their sole thing, is to defend the tribe or to conquer other tribes, right?
Bigger. That's the expression of masculine energy that's out of balance, and then the expression of the feminine that's out of balance is women who just keep their mouth shut and let the man do that. And it's been down through, and I'm not trying to sound sexist, this is just, it has been a changing of the guard, and we had to we have to experience everything for our total growth. But we've been there, we've done that. It's like, okay, we've done the war thing, and now is the time when that's coming to an end, because the masculine is about action, it's about doing, it's the hunting, it's the gathering, it's the protection, like you said, and if someone takes your resources, you go hit them over the head and get your resources back, and that is an out of balance society. Because the feminine principles which exist in men have been denied, and by the same token, the women were not given any kind of power. Although we have had, in our transmissions that we have had information about a matriarchal society which existed, and then it was a completely different reality. But there has to be changing of the guard. There has to be these different experiences so that we can have the total benefit,
right,
of knowing how to bring peace from times of war.
I think it's nice to be reminded all through history there have been those courageous men and women who knew between them, just because of the love between them, and all aspects, mental, physical, spiritual love. I mean, all of these, right? All the men and women, all through history, that, in a sense, were able to enjoy a kind of equality, to recognize and enjoy and share a kind of equality, is kind of what really has kept it going all the way along, too. It's actually the love and the sacrifice for each other, and that whole thing, too, is really what made it. That's actually what's tying it all together, right? Is that connecting force of love, in spite
That's
of
right.
all these other cultural things, right? There is a love of mothers and sisters and fathers and brothers and things that transcends just sometimes a cultural norm.
Right. Yeah. And there really is no greater earthly power than can be found when a man and a woman are united in equal balance, because it brings the best of both worlds. And then when they are, in this creative, sacred union, and I'm not just talking about a sexual act, but it is a state of being.
Right.
That that, to me, is the ideal that we're all shooting for. And there have been examples pop up here and there, and I fully expect and know that that's where we are moving when you know, women know how to have more courage and men know how to have more gentility, because right now, well, at least 50 years ago, it was really, really lopsided. But it's getting better.
Well, it just, yeah, of course, you. I saw the other day someone sent me an email of a young lady perched on the wing of her fighter aircraft, right? You know, so that's going to the other extreme where you have
exactly.
Women now.
And
I mean,
are,
you know,
there are women
flying those things, involved in warfare. You know,
too much masculinity. Then, but in a way, having. It's a little perverted, I guess, but having women enter military service is the beginning of a balance there.
Women all through history, have always got the all you got is like read the Bible and Sarah and some of the great women of history, but women all through history also have enjoyed the fruits of warfare. I mean, when the Vikings went off and brought back, you know, we'd raid some monastery, kill everybody in England, and bring back all that gold and jewelry, it was to show off, and it was for their women. It's like women have always enjoyed the fruits of battle and warfare, you know, of all the spoils being brought home was to impress the women, you know, so forth.
Yeah, right up until the time that their son was killed.
Right, exactly, or their husband, yeah.
Or her husband.
Yeah, someone they really loved, you know.
There was one war in history that the women were so upset about that they decided to clamp on these, like, chastity belts, and they just totally cut the men off. It's like, that's it, you're going to...
Well, that was a Greek play, and that never actually happened in history.
Never happened in history? Well,
you got to remember that women, just being the weaker sex, and not, I mean... women haven't liked their status all through history. It was just pure brutality. Look, when the Taliban took over in recent times, recently in Afghanistan, I mean, the Taliban, if a woman wasn't perfectly covered up or whatever their thing was, she could just be half beaten to death right on the spot. Just for an example, that's taking place today. If women don't behave, they're beaten. I mean, women don't lack courage. It's just they've been brutalized all through history, you know.
Well, those things are changing. Those things are changing, and women are becoming more balanced. Men are becoming more balanced, and together we will have peace on this planet. And with that, I am going to wrap it up. And thank you.
Well, that's why Mother Spirit is such a divine co-equal. In as I've been transcended, that there's almost no difference in terms of Michael, Creator Son of God, and a Creator Daughter of God. Mother Spirit, her Holy Spirit, is as much part of us as anything else. So that's one thing too. The Urantia book has that absolutely perfect respect and acknowledgement of the feminine.
Well, and of the masculine, it has to be totally equal and totally in balance, and that is the model and the ideal to which we are moving, I firmly believe.
I do too.
I firmly believe that.
Well, I've been transmitting it for 8 years now, so.
Well, there you go. Terry, right. I want to thank you so much for joining us this evening, and I will repeat, your website is evolving-souls.org.
Right.
And several times you referred to tmarchives.com, where people can go and start their own research and discovery. And just thank you so much for sharing this time with us.
Well, thank you. It's always wonderful. It's just such a delight to meet other spiritually curious people.
as long as we keep
our curiosity, I think curiosity is one of God's greatest gifts, right? Just to really be curious and wonder, and just be filled with wonder.
And it's easy to do every time you walk out into nature.
Amen.
And I really am a big proponent of that, staying connected to nature and Mother Earth. So with that, Jerry, thank you so much for sharing this time with us, and we would like to also thank our listeners for tuning in. And thanks to Chris and Fiona for handling the switchboard this evening. Lavendar, we're going to say goodnight now. I know you're still there. So we will like a little bit of a mic problem there. But thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you all next week. Thank you so much. Good night, everyone.
Good night, Nan. Thank you again.
You're so welcome. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.